Fish are central to the identity of this region, more specifically salmon and steelhead, born in the rivers, raised in the ocean, coming home to the rivers to make a new generation. Salmon tie together inland and ocean in ways both symbolic and ecological. We'll focus on the ecological for this next discussion, because recent research takes a look at the effects of climate change on runs of salmon and steelhead in the Northwest and California. The research gives us some idea of how the various fish runs are coping with the effects of climate and what those effects are. Our guest is Lisa Crozier, a research ecologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center in Seattle. Lisa, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, everybody.
Good to have you here. This is a central theme in your career, isn't it? The effect of climate change on animals.
Yes, this is something I've really felt passionately about for a long time as really the major issue of our time and the legacy we are going to leave for the next generation.
And I should point out that this is not just, you're not just dealing with water-based animals either.
No, climate change affects everything. It affects people very personally. It affects terrestrial organisms. I've focused specifically on butterflies, but it will affect insects and mammals and birds. We're seeing the effects across the entire spectrum. Every single area that you look, you see the effects.
Are salmon and other migrating species especially helpful to climate research?
Helpful to climate research? Well, they're complicated. I feel like they're helpful in the sense that they help us to understand how interconnected everything is and how dependent terrestrial landscapes are on the ocean environment and how things that happen thousands of kilometers away or miles away have an effect right here at home that we can actually see. So I think salmon are helpful in the sense that they bring the issues of climate change that are sometimes feel like they're happening someplace else right here at home.
Yeah, that particular part of it was brought home to us a few weeks ago in another discussion by someone who pointed out that some of the minerals that get into the upper streams in the West Coast forests get there because they're carried there in the bodies of fish.
That's exactly right. These ecosystems are very dependent. Salmon is considered a keystone species, and it's supplying nutrients to trees and wildlife throughout the watersheds that are connected to the ocean.
So this is a good lesson for us not to think in terms of like, you know, we just want the fish to be healthy. We want everything to be healthy, and the fish are an indicator of how the overall health is.
Well, that's true. And if the fish are healthy, also the people are healthy, because we also benefit from all of those services that those ecosystems provide. And a healthy watershed, it buffers floods naturally. It causes less so that we don't have to do as much with infrastructure development if we allow nature to take care of some of those problems for us. And both, for example, storm surges, flooding, natural wetlands are are a great natural buffer. And water soaking into the ground throughout the terrestrial area. So it really, if we allow nature to do our problems for us, it's much less expensive.
So in other words, you're saying we have to build less infrastructure if we just use what nature provides naturally.
That's right.
Wow. In general, would you say, Lisa, salmonids are survivors? Have they adapted well to changes throughout the millennia?
Absolutely. Salmon are opportunists, and they're incredibly adaptive. They have survived. They've evolved an anadromous life history specifically because there's so much natural disturbance. For example, all the volcanic eruptions that have occurred across the West Coast, the glacial periods, they're very good at recolonizing areas after they've become blocked. And that's one of the reasons why we're so successful when we do remove barriers, such as you've done in the Rogue and are working on in the Klamath. Dam removals are very successful for salmon because they're excellent at recolonizing good habitat. And they have a lot of adaptive capacity if we can just give them the natural resources they've always had to adapt.
All right. You anticipated some of the questions I'll be asking in probably 10 or 15 minutes about dams, but I want to come back to some of the major general points here. Lisa Crozier, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a research ecologist at NOAA's Northwest Fisheries Science Center. We're talking about recent research that she and a crew of people published called Climate Vulnerability Assessment for Pacific Salmon and Steelhead in the California Current Large Marine Ecosystem. We'll break down some of those terms. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about the things that salmonids have adapted to. What's going on now is a big change. The first sentence In the introduction of your paper, references large numbers of climate-related population extinctions in plants and animals. How sharp an uptick is this, Lisa?
Oh, it's huge. It's really, part of it is a detection issue in that although these extinctions have been happening gradually, there are certain tipping points. So there are sort of more subtle effects until something completely blinks out. And it's just over the past couple of decades that we've really seen the sharp deviation from when we've gone outside the range of historical variation. And we're starting to get to see more and more conditions that these populations have never experienced before.
So there's a normal zone, you're saying, of things that go on, you know, get extinct around us all the time. But we're outside that zone now.
Yes, we're well outside that, that zone.
You have done plenty of research on salmonids before. What did you do in the recent research, and what did that follow in previous research? What did you build upon?
Yes, so I've worked for a long time on trying to understand the individual links within a population. For example, if a population experiences high summer temperatures, how that affects survival, how it affects migration, how it affects marine survival. So I've really been looking mostly at the population scale. And the point here was to take a much higher view so that we can link the people who have that information on the ground, the tribal members, the state agencies, the biologists, the citizens who care a lot about their fish, and they understand all those individual links. But to scale that up for decision makers and people who are thinking at a much broader scale so we can see how these are not just problems locally, these are problems across the entire landscape. And there are patterns across the whole West Coast in terms of which climate factors are most important in which locations and for which life history types, so that we can really do long-range planning. Because the main issue that emerged is that these problems are very large in scale, so that we're going to have to develop these mega coalitions to cooperate, and everybody needs to be speaking the same language and really understand the connectedness across habitats that salmon have and how large the solutions need to be.
There is some of that already, isn't there? Cooperation across jurisdictional boundaries?
Absolutely. And that is such a good example. And it's the only way we have started to get things done on a large scale. So you've done that down in with your dam removals in your region. The Yakima Basin is also a really good example of how they've brought together native interests and citizens, water rights owners, agricultural interests, the people who are worried about damage to the dams, infrastructure, and environmentalists, and everybody is coming together so that they can actually think through the complexity of this. Because, you know, if there's one take-home, it's that climate change is complex. It's going to affect many different things. So we really need to be talking and coordinating our actions so that they're effective.
Are we finding that there are things that will help one species that hurt another as we try to correct for the effects of climate change?
Well, I think we might sort of think that in the short term, but in reality, that's sort of an artifact of the fact that everything is so precarious right now. So really, in the long range, well, I suppose you could say invasive, sort of weedy species in general benefit more from climate change than our more native species. But in general, I think we make a big deal out of some trade-offs that are sort of red herrings.
Lisa, talk about, and we are talking about fish, so it seems appropriate, but talk about the geographical scope of the work you did recently.
So we covered all of the contiguous western U.S., so that's Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and California. And so essentially we were focused on all of the salmon, the Pacific salmon and steelhead that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So it's across the whole West Coast.
So you basically went to the endangered species list, but with some exceptions.
Well, we made sure we included everything that was listed on the endangered species, but there are some species like pink salmon and chum salmon, which don't have very many evolutionarily significant units listed under the Endangered Species Act, and we just wanted to make sure we included them for perspective across salmonids, well, across salmon species.
Almost like a control group in a sense?
Well,
or at least a not listed group.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
All right. So it looks like about half the salmonids in the region are on the endangered species list as either threatened or endangered or at least sensitive.
Yes, That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Because they interact with people in so many different ways. And everywhere there's, the more intense the competition is for water, the more of their habitat becomes limited and they grow more endangered.
So once you chose what to look at, I mean, what measurements, what facts and figures did you pull for each run to indicate overall health and issues challenging that health?
Yes, so we really looked at kind of three separate issues. One is just from a climate perspective, just geographically, what are the climate factors that are more important for each region? So that's just defining the area where the salmon, each individual ESU is. Then we looked at the life history of each species and sort of population group to figure out which life stage is exposed to which environmental factors, which has already shown signs of climate stress. And there, a lot of that information is in the, every 5 years, NOAA does reviews of the status of all species listed under the Endangered Species Act. So a lot of that information is already being tabulated, but we wanted to organize it and present it in a systematic framework where it could be compared more easily. So a lot of this information is in the official government documents as well as the peer-reviewed literature as well as sometimes additional information.
When you say ESU, that's evolutionarily significant unit?
Yes, I'm sorry. That's distinct okay. Population segments is the formal term for how subspecies are listed under the Endangered Species Act.
Okay, so I'm reminded again of just how much variety there is from run to run. I mean, some salmon spend years in salt water, some less. I mean, how big are the variations in behavior and timing of the freshwater return?
Well, they're absolutely enormous. And sometimes you have all of that variation within one species. So steelhead are really the masters of diversity in life history types. So they have everything from an entirely landlocked form, which is rainbow trout, to an anadromous form, which may spend anywhere from just 1 year to 3 to 4 years in freshwater. They go out to sea. They can spend a wide variety of time out there. They come back, and naturally, actually, they would go back out to sea and then come back and spawn again. Other species, like pink salmon, are much more constrained. So they spend very, very, very short time, just a few months in freshwater. They spawn and go immediately back out to sea, and they return at age 2. It's a very sort of specified life history type. So it runs the whole gamut.
Lisa Crozier, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a research ecologist with the Northwest Fisheries Science Center of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We're talking about recent research that looked at the impacts upon salmonids, salmon, and steelhead of climate change. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So then the fish obviously have very different kinds of behaviors. As you point out, a lot of variation just within steelhead. How different than the distribution of climate effects? Are those also very different run to run?
Yes, this turned out to be very interesting. So we looked at 4 major freshwater factors and 4 major marine factors, and of those, there really were some important differences. So summer stream temperatures are most important for the life history types that are in the fresh water over summer. So those are the yearling juvenile life histories, yearling Chinook, steelhead, and coho, who tend to actually inhabit streams in over summer, and also the adult life stages that have adapted long migrations to reach distant locations where they're migrating over summer and holding over summer. So summer temperatures are more important for those life history types, especially the interior and the sort of long freshwater residents. Then there are, the flow effects, so flow affects salmon throughout the year, and different locations are a little more sensitive at different times of year. So in the fall and winter, it's flooding that's most dramatic, and actually your region in southern Oregon and northern California is the one that's expected to experience the greatest change in these atmospheric river events, the Pineapple Express, that brings these massive flooding events that damages lots of infrastructure. It's warm air coming across the Pacific from Hawaii, can melt whatever snow has come out, causes a lot of flooding. Those events are expected to become more intense and more frequent with climate change. From a salmon perspective, they tend to wash out eggs that are in the ground and push fry out of the headwaters. Over the winter in the interior and higher elevation locations, snowpack is more important. And as winter temperatures rise, regardless of what happens with precipitation, more of that snow is coming down as rain and melting out earlier in the spring. So those interior populations especially have evolved to migrate to sea on these very large spring freshets. So these smolts are traveling 1,200 kilometers in some cases, and they ride these large spring freshets out to sea. So with declining snowpack, it's those populations that are at greatest risk to that factor. And we found that almost 100% of the spawning area of Snake River, the Snake River populations, is going to switch from snow-dominated to either transitional or rain-dominated. So that'll be a major impact in that region. In the summer, drought is a huge impact. Obviously, loss of water affects humans and it affects the fish. And again, that's going to be important for the infrastructure management in general, which affects salmon throughout the year, as well as the fish that are trying to make a living in freshwater in summer.
Let's take a phone call. We have William in Sutherland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lisa Crozier from the Northwest Fisheries Science Center. Hi, William.
I can't hardly hear you.
I can hear you now, though. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I hear you fine now. But you haven't mentioned the most invasive species of all.
Which one?
Affecting our salmon.
Is that humans?
The white man.
Uh-huh.
Look what we're doing to this place.
I agree.
Go up in the Coast Range, look around and see how much timber's been cut. Mm-hmm. It looks like a war zone. I live on a little stream here that actually ends up in the Umpqua River.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk up this stream. There's a place up the road where you can turn. There's a turnout, and it's right on the creek. And I walk up the stream, and there's plastic, people throwing stuff out of their cars. I've even found dirty diapers hanging in the underbrush.
Oh, boy. So a lot of effects there for sure. William, thanks for the call and for the color you're adding to the story here. But this is an ongoing issue. I mean, even without the issues of climate change, there are already some severe impacts on salmonids, aren't there?
Well, and that's right. And in fact, one of the other major conclusions that we found is that the populations that are most vulnerable to climate change have actually already experienced the greatest extinction rate within their ESUs. And it's not coincidence. It's the ones that have been blocked off from a lot of their historical habitat. They've lost they've already declined significantly, and they are incredibly rare. And some of the absolutely unique life history types, like winter run Chinook down in the Sacramento River, is totally unique throughout the world, and that one is at extremely high risk.
So there's obviously no magic wand here, are there still some relatively simple steps left? Is there low-hanging fruit, as it were, things that we can do to aid salmon populations that hasn't been done already?
Well, we've definitely done all of the individual steps. What needs to happen is it needs to be coordinated across large basins because salmon work at a large spatial scale. So we've already identified all of the low-hanging fruits and we are working on them, but we just need to put those into context of the whole population level.
You referenced the removals of dams already on the Rogue River. Three have come out in the last 10 years. And the plan to take out four dams on the Klamath River, is this the kind of thing that gets a person in your line of work excited?
Absolutely. And the Elwha also. The thing is, they come back right away. And if you can open up access to this really high-quality habitat, that is what salmon need to maintain large enough population sizes so that they can handle an extreme climate event and still come back. And I think what's really spectacular about the Rogue is that they've seen rebounding populations despite difficult situations in the ocean. And that shows that if you just give them access to this very high quality habitat, they can tolerate what are otherwise difficult environmental events.
But even if the change from the climate is permanent, as you talk about, you know, snow-based ecosystems turning into rain-based ecosystems, that's a very different kind of stream for fish to live in, isn't it?
Well, that's right. But salmon are very adaptive, and there are life history types within each of these species that can accommodate those changes.
And I don't know if I asked about specific runs that appear to be taking climate effects the hardest.
Well, the two Runs we worry the most about are winter run Chinook and redfish lake sockeye at the moment. So both of those are already critically endangered, and winter run is totally dependent on storage in the Shasta Dam Reservoir of cold water, because these fish have evolved at higher elevations, and their eggs are in the water over summer. And so they're dependent on releases from this cold water releases from the reservoir to survive their incubation period. And when you have a long drought, like we had in California, they ran out of cold water. And so there was a run failure in that population. Redfish Lake sockeye also are extremely vulnerable. They migrate 1,200 kilometers through the Columbia and Snake Rivers. We had extremely hot temperatures in 2015. And again, almost none of those fish survived to the spawning ground. So these populations are already very sensitive to climate extremes, and they're at very high risk.
Lisa, I saw a YouTube video of you briefing journalists through the Metcalf Institute 6 years ago, which brings up the question about how well journalists relay the information that you provide. I mean, are there still some things that journalists and so the general public still fundamentally misunderstand about the on-the-ground effects of climate change?
I'm not sure. It's so complicated that I think the take-home is that there are things we can do, but we need to cooperate and think at large scales and communicate with each other. I think there is often confusion about the details, but I think the big picture is that salmon need clean, cold water, and we know how to provide that to them. We just need the political will to make that happen, and it will be a benefit to all of us.
All right. There were a bunch of different authors with you on this research, weren't there?
Yes. Yes, we had a lot of, basically we wanted experts on all of the individual regions, because it's a lot of information that we synthesized, and we wanted to make sure we weren't missing anything really important about individual populations.
All right. It's got that staid title of Climate Vulnerability Assessment for Pacific Salmon and Steelhead in the California Current Large Marine Ecosystem, but you just heard from Lisa Crozier some of the details about it. Lisa is a research ecologist at NOAA's Northwest Fisheries Science Center in Seattle. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a nice day.
You too.